man revisits the stations of his life as he travels across the River Styx, perhaps, in Hans Werner Henze's Barcarola, performed to open tonight's BBC Prom live here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nussum. The first thing he did was to get tonight's principal viola, Caroline Harrison, to her feet. Lots to watch in that performance. Elizabeth Burley reaching into the piano with a wire brush, the sound of the rasp of the contrabass clarinet, and David White on the heckle phone, played by John Alford, and the trombones standing for Karen's summons towards the end. Dedicated to the memory of the composer and Bertolt Brecht collaborator Paul Dessau, for whom Henze had great admiration, and a fitting memorial to Henze himself, who died last year at the age of 86. Back comes Oliver Nussum. He sits to conduct, very tall man, but incredibly dynamic and clear, but with a lyrical beat. The brass being brought to their feet by Oliver Nussum, and now the woodwind. Oliver Nussum, also a very collaborative musician, is lucky enough to play piano in a Ligeti piece for Hans Werner Henze some 30 or so years ago, and I stayed on to watch him rehearsing Mahler's Fifth Symphony. I remember the cellos being shocked. They didn't quite know what to say when he asked them how he could help in a particular passage. It was very removed from the dictatorial style they were used to. And Sven Henze as conductor. Oliver Nussum tonight conducting Henze's Barcarola. Well, it seems extraordinary that the American pianist Peter Serkin has never yet played at the BBC Proms, but it's tonight he makes his Proms debut in two concertante works by Stravinsky. Before that can happen, though, we have a piano move on the Albert Hall stage. And in a Proms season that offers over 20 piano concertos, there are some real logistical challenges to overcome. Earlier today, our Proms roving reporter Georgia Mann spoke to two people at the heart of the operation.
Well, I think one man who may be able to shed some light on these pianistic manoeuvrings is piano technician Robert Padgham from Steinway's, who I can hear tinkering with tonight's piano right now. So let's go and get some insight from him. Now, you've already been here this morning, tuning a little bit. You're back again. It's about 4:30. Mm-hmm. Is that the usual process? Just how much goes into getting these instruments finally tuned?
Quite a bit, especially in this hall, in this weather, having had one of the hottest summers we've had for quite a few years, isn't it? The pianos are going up and they're going down. Atmosphere in here can be very varied. So this morning, it was pretty much okay. It has dropped a little bit over the space of the afternoon rehearsal.
Are you likely to be back again? Will you have to be called in for any more?
I'm here just in case. I'll be sat in the back somewhere waiting for anything to break, which, touch wood, it won't do.
So it's not just tuning the piano, which is a challenge. It's also moving it into position, and sometimes very briskly under pressurised circumstances. I spoke earlier on to Rupert Casey, who is the stage manager for the BBC Symphony Orchestra, about just how he gets that job done.
It's very specific how an orchestra sits, how much space they need, whether they've got contact with their principals, and a player will come up and say, this particular player in front of me is tall, I can't see the conductor, can we move over there?
Or, yes, that's a fatal flaw, I would have thought.
and trumpet players are blowing straight into the back of me, can we move? So we're constantly sort of working out which is the best way for them to sit. So it is actually quite specific, and we often mark chairs and stands so when we come on we can see exactly where everyone was sitting for the rehearsal, so we can get it back sort of within an inch of being right, yeah.
And I just have to ask, battle stories, have there been times when when your heart has sunk, that you've known you've got a great big move involving a piano and seconds to go and it just isn't happening as planned?
Yeah, a few times that's happened. You just suddenly look round and something that you were expecting to be there isn't, or something that is there shouldn't be. It's all good fun. Most of the time the audience, they know it well enough how things work, and they spot the mistakes and they enjoy it as well, I think.
Audience participation.
Yeah,
in the
very
stage
much
moves.
Yeah,
that's what I like to hear. Rupert, thanks so much. I'll let you get back
okay,
to work.
Okay, thank you.
Rupert Casey and our roving reporter Georgia Mann will be talking to members of the orchestra later in the evening. Well, the piano has been carefully manoeuvred centre stage for Peter Serkin to play Stravinsky's Concerto for Piano and Wind Instruments. He wrote it in the mid-1920s, at the start of a period when, based in Paris, he spent a lot of time touring as a concert pianist. He practiced intensively to bring his technique up to scratch and wrote the piano part to highlight his own strengths. The idea of the concerto, of highlighting individual virtuosity, had always appealed to Stravinsky. What appealed less was a concerto for solo instrument and orchestra in the classical and romantic sense. In the 1920s, Stravinsky began to explore neo-baroque forms and textures, and this concerto is part of that, scored for woodwind and brass with timpani and double basses, an echo of 18th-century serenades and perhaps contemporary jazz bands. The missing players are the impassioned strings of 19th-century music. Tonight's conductor, Oliver Nassen.
I remember when I first heard about the piano concerto, one was always, oh yes, it's very dry. Actually, when I heard it, I remember there's an electric charge to it. It's harmonically so spiky. There are references to all kinds of... It's the beginning it almost sounds like a reference to the Chopin Funeral March and all that. And there's also little bits of Bach and little bits of Russian-ness, umpari kind of accompaniments. There are all kinds of things in this, quote, dry neoclassical world. And the instrumentation, the way he uses the piano and the winds, and especially the horns, is just miraculous. It's a whole new world. It's like the a very, very hyper-classical big band. But there weren't big bands in those days. They hadn't really been invented. This is an ur-big band music. And actually, the other thing about it, when you first hear it, is it does not sound like the type of music that's going to have a lot of depth. It's very, very beautifully done, but it's a surface. And Peter Serkin and I, we played this piece many times together, but we were saying how wonderful it was to come back to it and how much more one found in it than before. And that, in fact, under that surface, there is a lot of detail and a lot of little things that you didn't notice last time.
Well, Oliver Nassen's known Peter Serkin for many years, so on the occasion of the pianist's Proms debut at the age of 66, I asked Ollie to tell us about his friend.
Peter Serkin is a pianist I've admired for many, many years. I think since I first heard him play the Schoenberg Concerto at Tanglewood in, I think, about 1970 or 71. And he was a pianist of great independence of mind and thoughtfulness and sort of hyper musical. For the last 25 years, really, we've worked together fairly regularly, and he's an astonishing collaborator, apparently without any ego at all. He wants very much to integrate into the performance that is being made together. So one of a kind.
Oliver Nassen on Peter Serkin. Well, we're hearing two very different pieces of Stravinsky this evening. Talking in 1972, Michael Tippett suggested that however many times he reinvented himself as a composer, Stravinsky was still Stravinsky.
Stravinsky was, in my opinion, the greatest of the creative giants who came to maturity by the First World War. At the same time, he lived till last year and was creating fresh works almost up to his death, so that his creative life extends over a really extraordinary long period. And we think of this period of his life as being a time of extreme change and innovations in all sorts of styles in music, and indeed in all the arts. And we also imagine that Stravinsky always had a constant relationship and interest to these changing styles. And yet, the strange thing is that in all his work, from the earliest to the end, the sense of it being one person's thumbprint, one person's sound, is absolute. And this, I think, is useful at this time for us to realize that whatever the time spirit may be doing, that the great works that express this spirit still seem to come out of the individual genius.
Michael Tippett talking in 1972. Well, returning to the piece we're about to hear, the concerto for piano and wind instruments, the main fast section of the first of the three movements is in typical Stravinsky neoclassical style. For classical, read Baroque, its textures coming straight from Bach's keyboard music, with the rhythms of ragtime and jazz thrown into the mix as well. That bravo, by the way, was the page turner playing the A to set the tuning in motion. But in this piece, there are still ideas and colours from Stravinsky's earlier work, which had fed so much from Russian culture. The patchwork of his ballet Petrushka isn't far away, except perhaps the Russian dances are supplanted by American jazz as it crossed the Atlantic to Stravinsky's new home in Paris. It's not overtly emotional music in any way, something Stravinsky was always saying music was incapable of being. He seems determined to have fun in the concerto, the often helter-skelter music suddenly heading off in abruptly different directions. Well, the hefty stage move is complete. The wind and brass are in position with the double basses, and here comes a very dapper Peter Serkin onto the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall, saying hello and shaking the hands of principal wind players before he turns to the front of the platform and bows to the promenaders and the rest of the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. Stravinsky's Concerto for Piano and Wind Instruments.
Thank you.
The hijinks of the finale of Stravinsky's Concerto for Piano and Wind Instruments, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on Radio 3 by Peter Serkin, making his Proms debut with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nutton. Peter Serkin almost unwilling to take the applause himself, almost begging the members of the Symphony Orchestra to get to their feet. They're getting a fine reception from the audience here in the hall. Very dapper figure in a pinstripe suit. Plays from music, but with great passion and commitment. Or I should say, and with great passion and commitment. Going off stage, huge thumbs up to the trombones. And they love that. Stravinsky, having taken time out from writing the concerto to get his technique to the point where he could play what he'd written, he gave some 40 performances over 5 years. He's rather plagued with memory lapses himself. He should have used the music. Suddenly become obsessed by ideas that the audience were a collection of dolls, he said, and various things. Anyway, Peter Serkin is back on the platform, now beaming and taking the applause from the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. Extraordinary that this is his Proms debut. I remember seeing him playing a two-piano concerto. Could it have been the Mozart with his father, Rudolf Serkin? Oh, back in the 60s, I would guess. Of course, not only his father, but his grandfather, the violinist and composer Adolf Busch, so a fantastic musical heritage. Has specialised in 20th and 21st century music, but also in Mozart. Back he comes, here with Oliver Nutton. Oliver Nutton bringing the four horns to their feet before raising the rest of the wind, brass, timps and double basses. Well, in 20 minutes' time, Peter Serkin will be back on the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Oliver Nutton to play some very different Stravinsky, which he composed some 35 years later, his Movements for Piano and Orchestra. And that's followed by music written in England at almost exactly the same time, Michael Tippett's Magical Second Symphony. And it's Tippett's words in his letters and writings which take centre stage here on Radio 3 during the interval in the Royal Albert Hall as we head down to the Royal College of Music, where earlier this evening Rana Mitter was in the chair for a Proms Plus literary event.
The Royal College of Music, where we're sitting now, has produced some pretty impressive alumni. But one of the most prominent has to be the man whose second symphony we'll hear in the latter half of tonight's prom, Michael Tippett. Tippett had a stark and rather startlingly clear sense of his own standing in 20th century music. He once wrote, "I'm not as gifted as Ben Britten, but more experienced and capable than Henser," who's also on tonight's programme, of course. The reputation of many of Tippett's works remains strong. A Child of Our Time, Midsummer Marriage, Double Fantasia. But what was it that made this most contradictory of modern musical figures, the gay, conscientious objector who spent time in Wormwood Scrubs and ended up as a somewhat respectable musical knight of the realm? Well, to unpick the man behind the mask of time, that is, and to give a frank assessment of how we should rate him, please welcome the critics Ivan Hewitt and Oliver Soden. Ivan, I've been reading some of Michael Tippett's letters written over many decades to get a flavour of the man. And I have to say, he comes off as someone with a strong, let's say it, egotistical sense of his own centrality.
Yes, I think that's probably putting it mildly. Michael Tippett had this extraordinary intellectual self-confidence from a very early age. In childhood, he tells us, he went to his father's bookcase and pulled down volumes on psychoanalysis and Greek philosophy and devoured them. He tells us of the thrill of discovering Kant's Critique of Pure Reason at a pretty you know, tender age. He seems to be somebody who could just override any form of doubt. You know, there was the spectacle of Benjamin Britten, 8 years younger than him, his career steaming ahead of Tippett's, you know, in the 1930s and 40s. One doesn't get much of a sense that Tippett was in any way rattled by this, or, you know, or jealous. Or he was absolutely sure of his own path from the beginning.
And we will want to get to that question of the friendship with Britten, but let's stick with Tippett himself for a moment here, Oliver, because one of the other things you get from these letters is, again, a great frankness. I mean, we've mentioned psychoanalysis. Jung is someone who he was very devoted to, and a strong sense of his own sexuality as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, on the first page of his autobiography, he speaks with absolute candor about his botched circumcision aged 5, and you have to sort of take a deep breath and go with him and stop your toes curling. And the point is that his toes aren't curling, and I really think this candor about not only his sexuality but his politics and all sorts of beliefs is not there to embarrass or to shock. It's there through a real sense of honesty, candor, that he really can do nothing other than write what comes into his head, and at the time it comes into his head as well.
One of the curious things for me about reading the autobiography in particular is how extraordinary those dreams are. He gives nearly 100 pages to talking about his dreams, you know, which could be thought to be a very tactless thing. I went to a performance of Laurie Anderson's latest musical extravaganza at the Barbican recently, and one of the great lines in that is, "Never tell anybody your dreams." You know, it's a kind of social faux pas. The wonderful thing about Tippett is he doesn't know what a social faux pas is. You know, he's wonderfully candid at all times.
Yes.
He expresses himself perhaps at greater length than he ought to. And these.
Do you want to give us an example of that, Ivan?
Oh, well,
what kind of faux pas are we talking about here?
Well, the one that sticks in my memory, or two actually that stick in my memory, one is of a game of tennis where the fourth person, he says, in a game of doubles is obscure. And he says, this is exactly as one would expect. The fourth is always obscure, you know. And that, of course, he's referring to that part of Jungian theory, which says, I think this is what it is, where one of the psychological faculties is immersed in the sea of the unconscious and therefore not amenable to consciousness. And so
yes,
that's why one member of the tennis doubles team can't be seen. Tippett's dreams have a wonderful way of fitting in with Jungian symbolism in a way which mine never do. I never have these kind of dreams. You know, I have experienced serious dream envy.
Yes.
You obviously want to spend a bit more time on the couch, Ivan. We can see to that later, perhaps. But I don't want to give the idea, we mustn't give the idea, that this is a man who lived entirely in a world of his own ego, because we mentioned politics. And
yes,
one of the things that comes, it seems to me, from this absolute central core conviction is the politics of pacifism. And one of his greatest moments of personal crisis came in the middle of World War II. As a pacifist, he refused to do military-related work, and he realized that he would end up being sentenced to prison, which he nicknamed Quad, in fact.
Yes.
And I think we can hear a letter to his friend, the musician Francesca Allanson, that talks about this impending imprisonment. And Oliver, I think you can read that for us.
6th of February, 1942, to Francesca Allanson. David, and everyone almost else, is trying to get me to compromise, but I am realizing that mere social work won't replace the music. Only pacifist witness against the whole madness can do so. I am going through a considerable moral crisis, and on the issue will depend whether I can witness outside or inside Quad. I am not frightened by Quad anymore, but my friends are for me. I intend to do that thing which will most clearly show the measure of the world debacle now that my own island has been shattered. It will only be for a time, whatever I decide to do. Mercifully, a portion of my musical self has got out into the big world, and Walter Gerr and others are willing to hold its baby hand while Papa is away from home. I want very much to have the knowledge that things will go on for that side of me by my friends, while I am doing my other enforced job of witness. That will make everything ever so much easier.
Thank you, Oliver. And Ivan, I want to turn to you because, as we know, Tippett, in fact, was sentenced and did serve, I think, 3 months in Wormwood Scrubs as a conscientious objector before he was released. And this really is him walking the walk on pacifism. Is that fair?
Perhaps it is. Yes, he did indeed. And he made sure that his time in Wilbur Scruggs was usefully spent. You know, he organized musical performances, wrote lots of letters, seemed to do an enormous amount of thinking, and seems to have been fortified by the experience.
Were the inhabitants of Wilbur Scruggs interested in modernism?
That I wouldn't like to say.
Well, he certainly taught a daughter of one of his jailers music, but he did describe the orchestra in the prison as light cafe music, and the orchestra had actually been formed by Ivor Novello, who was actually in prison for diddling his petrol coupons to keep his Rolls Royce running during the war.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So he was driving the drive rather than.
I have to say, I wasn't aware that quite so much of Britain's cultural establishment was actually spending time in Chokey during World War II. Things one learns. The letter, Oliver, is to Francesca Allanson, whom he nicknamed Fresca, an immensely close friend and therefore someone to whom he could be very frank about these ideas.
Yes, I mean, I think when it, as far as we can tell, and who are we to say, but as far as one can tell, when it came to the biology and mechanics of sex, Tippett was gay, and he certainly, his two major partners in his life were men. But he does seem to have maintained throughout his life a series of what we might call passionate friendships with women, one of the major ones of whom was Francesca Allanson, as you say, a writer, a musician. They were working together on a monograph about the Irish influence on British folk song. She was also a published novelist, and they were going to get married, according to Tippett, presumably chastely, but they did want a child together. Mm-hmm. But she was in a terrible state by the end of the war, physically, mentally, and in despair, not only at her own sickness, but at the sickness of the world. She threw herself off a bridge into the River Stour at the end of 1945, which, well, the devastation to Tippett was extraordinary. So this was another thing during the war, which was running symbiotically with all his mental trauma, I think.
It's interesting, this ambiguity about his sexuality, and I wonder whether that doesn't apply also to his politics. You know, because one thinks of Tippett as a man of the left, and some of the letters are really quite fiercely anti-capitalist, also anti-imperial. That's one of the things that struck me about the letters that I hadn't expected to find. Which
he wanted Hitler to win, he says in one of the letters.
Well, I think we need to explain that, because there is actually this letter, I think, in 1936, before the war starts, to the communist. I mean, at that time, Tippett was in the Communist Party, I think, and he wrote to another communist composer, Alan Bush, and said, I hope that Hitler wins. Now, how did he get round that particular statement, Ivan?
Well, I think, like many, you know, fellow travellers of the left, he wised up, and he just seems to have wised up rather quicker than some. You know, one of the reasons he eventually fell out with the Communist Party was that he couldn't stand the orthodox Stalinist line. You know, he was much more of a Trotskyist.
He was the Trotskyist, and
And how typical of Tippett to attach himself to the romantic outsider in the communist movement.
But is there a danger we're letting him off the hook a bit too much there? Because to make that statement, even in 1936, even as part of his anti-imperialist stance, to say, I hope Hitler wins, that's a big statement.
Maybe, I mean, this is maybe getting a little close to the knuckle, but one shouldn't forget that Tippett took part in various enterprises to ameliorate the conditions of the working man, particularly in the north of England, a place called Boosbeck in Yorkshire, where he must have fallen in with that rather strange character, Rolf Gardiner, a curious man who had this strange mystical idea that the English, particularly the English, should get back to the soil. He had racist views, not unlike those of Percy Grainger, you know, didn't like the Mediterranean races very much, was very keen on the northern races, later became quite pronouncedly anti-Semitic. And one wonders whether something of that very, that idea of a kind of aristocratic, of a kind of nobility of intellect and art didn't leave a mark on Tippett.
I think so. And of course, Francesca Allanson also owned a very similar establishment. Doolittle's Farm, it was called, just outside East Grinstead in West Sussex. And Tippett, along with lots of other conscientious objectors, went to work on the soil. And that's where Tippett met many of his early lovers and friends. And I think you're absolutely right, yes.
There is that extraordinary moment in is it the autobiography where he puts forward an idea of a vision of what the artist should be, which could have come straight out of the pages of D.H. Lawrence or Yeats. You know,
he was a great reader of Yeats, of course.
Great reader of Yeats.
Obsessive.
I wonder if that actually accounts for some of the cussedness you see there, because I think we mentioned he was in prison for conscientious objection, and you know, one has to feel a certain sympathy.
But we should go a step further. Not only did he refuse to do military service, he refused to do all the get-out clauses that were offered him.
Well, absolutely, but is this an admirable thing? Because essentially by the end, you know, the British government appeared to be saying, look, we'll find you anything that, you know, sits within this wide spectrum of possibilities. Please don't make us send you to prison. And he appears to have, you know, basically reached the stage by which nothing except what he personally defined as the alternative would do.
Oh, there's an aspect of the martyr in him, and he wrote when he got to prison, I've come home. You know, this was something I think he might have got from his mother, who was also imprisoned as a suffragette for a brief time. So I think there is a bit of the, you know, the person taking upon himself all the great horrors of the world.
Not perhaps the easiest of people to deal with, in other words, particularly if you're a British government fighting the Nazis at the time.
Exactly. Well, Vaughan Williams wrote to him, I don't agree with a single word of your pacifist beliefs, but I do admire you for holding them with the conviction you do, and I don't think anybody could disagree with that.
Britain, we've mentioned more than once, a very long-standing relationship with Tippett. And, Oliver, we have excerpts here from a couple of Tippett's letters to Britain that you've brought together, which date actually from the post-war period, the mid-1950s, about the time of the Second Symphony. Would you read for us?
Yes. My dear Ben, it was heaven to see you again and put hands on you in the flesh. Aldeburgh has had not only a wonderful recuperative effect on me, but it helped to settle my mind in what I want to do. I sigh all the time for your wonderful ease of composition, and what I can steal, I do. There's a lovely phrase from Albert Herring, not my favourite of your works, as you know, which I've got into the most splendid aria of The Midsummer Marriage. It was nice to hear from you just how the old Symphony No. 2 struck you. I'm still very much under the impact of it to myself. It meant a great deal inside. Adrian Bolt proved woefully pusillanimous. But the leader, Paul Beard, was more than inadequate. He'd set out to make trouble and succeeded. There's some long hangover there with regard to my music. You've been much in my mind lately. For better or worse, we too are the most interesting English music has at the moment. Love to you both. Dear, dear Ben. Michael.
Oliver, thank you. And Ivan, he refers there to the first performance of the Second Symphony, which, again, we'll hear in tonight's prom, but that first performance was notoriously an absolute disaster, wasn't it?
It was. It fell apart very, you know, within a few bars, had to be restarted by poor old Adrian Bolt, you know, who must have felt somewhat at sea in this peculiar modern music. He certainly wasn't the first choice of a conductor for the work. There are a number of stories around as to quite why it fell to pieces. It is a challenging work, even now. I mean, that violin entry, as we'll hear later, is perilous. And the syncopations and the woodwind lines make it a tricky...
It is.
Wouldn't you say?
I would, and there is... Tippett has a rhythmical way with notes. He called it additive rhythm, which is actually, to our ears now, I think, quite simple. But
yes.
To the ears of the 1950s, was deemed distinctly eccentric, not only in the way it sounded, but in the way Tippett noted the music on the page. Paul Beard, who he mentions in this letter, the leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, supposedly, who knows the truth of this, went off and rewrote all the scores, all the string
yes.
parts, re-notated them so that the notes would not be barred or grouped over the bar lines. And he did this, so I understand, between rehearsal and concert. I can't believe that was
Yes, and
helpful.
He did it without telling Sir Adrian.
Yes.
That was the problem, which was a mean trick, I think.
Ivan, we mentioned, I mean, this comes from the letter to Britain, and obviously the relationship between them was long and it was close. But that phrase, you know, Tippett's own assessment of himself as not as gifted as Ben, keeps coming into my mind. Do you think that was running through his mind as the correspondence with Britain and the relationship with him went on?
Well, I wonder whether what he really meant was, I may not be as gifted as you in that way, but I have this other thing.
Oh,
you know?
Yes.
What do you think the other thing is?
I think the other thing is that, to go back to where we started, really, that extraordinary intellectual self-confidence which allows him to build an imaginative world, as far as one can tell, unaided. In a way, they're polar opposites. You know, Britain was so perfectly secure and confident musically, but needed guidance outside music, I think. You know,
yes.
we know that he leant very heavily on Auden to form his literary tastes. Tippett seems to have discovered everything for himself.
It's crude, but I think a Mozart-Beethoven division is not unhelpful.
Yes.
I mean, in that Britain has this...
Which
Mozart
one is which?
Exactly. In that Britain... It was Tippett who called Britain divinely gifted, and Britain always has this Mozartian sense of taking dictation from God, and it all just comes out on the page beautifully formed. With Tippett, you have this absolutely Beethovenian sense of struggle. Every single note on the page takes days of
Let me look you in the eyes, Oliver, and say, am I wrong for thinking that Britten is a greater composer than Tippett?
Yes, very much so, I believe.
I think that that question of different types of creativity, though, leads us to the next reading, which is from the script Tippett wrote for a film that he'd made in collaboration with the director Misha Scorer, called Poets in a Barren Age. And it was part of a BBC television series called One Pair of Eyes, which went out in 1972. Oliver.
I've been writing music for 40 years. During those years, there have been huge and world-shattering events in which I have been inevitably caught up. Whether society has felt music valuable or needful, I have gone on writing because I must. And I know that my true function within a society which embraces all of us is to continue a tradition fundamental to our civilization, which goes back into prehistory and will go forward into the unknown future. This tradition is to create images from the depths of the imagination and to give them form, whether visual, intellectual, or musical. For it is only through images that the inner world communicates at all. Images of the past, shapes of the future. Images of vigor for a decadent period. Images of calm for one too violent. Images of reconciliation for worlds torn by division. And in an age of mediocrity and shattered dreams, images of abounding, generous, exuberant beauty.
Oliver, what you just read to us is an immensely articulate and, of course, verbalized expression of Tippett's artistic vision.
Yes.
I mean, would the accusation, perhaps unfair, be that for him, by the stage, the words are doing too much and the music not enough?
Oh, God, he'd hate to hear you say that, I'm sure. Do you mean the words that he's written here on the page?
The sense of using the words to try and make a case for the music rather than letting the music do it itself.
Tippett was certainly someone who wanted to explain himself, and thousands and thousands of letters and three volumes of essays in an autobiography testify to that. I mean, when it comes to writing on music, I don't think it gets better than what I've just read out, personally.
Also, isn't part of the problem that he feels he's up against it in a way, that... there's another, if I may, just drop in another little reading which shows that despite his great generosity, Tippett is remarkable for the fact that he, on the whole, doesn't take cudgels to his audience. You know, he's different to the modernist composers, and he does not despise his public. But there is one moment in an essay he wrote on composer and his public where he says, when he's discussing the question, why was it that Bartok fared so badly later in life? And he says, surely the matter is that the very big public masses together in a kind of death passion mediocrity. And that this blanket of mediocrity, whether communist or capitalist, is deeply offended by any living passion of the unusual, the rare, the rich, the exuberant, the heroic, and the aristocratic. So he's recycling that list, but now saying, the reason I have to fight for it is that they, the masses, don't like it or are hostile to it. And I must admit, when I read that, I have a slight moment of disappointment. I think, oh dear, Tippett's slipping into that language of the masses, which the fearful right-wingers used to slip into, you know, people like Yeats and...
I think partly what that reading draws up, and perhaps this is another important difference between him and Britten, Tippett did, I think he cared very deeply about his audience and what his music would do, but he did not write for specific occasions, he did not write for specific people, he did not do particularly that Britten thing of writing Gloriana for a Jubilee or a Sinfonia de Requiem for the Japanese emperors or whatever he did. He wrote because he had to write, and while the audience is important, what is more important is writing what you have to write without any... having to pander in any way to any particular commission. He wrote The Midsummer Marriage, his first opera, which is 700 pages, a full score, 4 hours, no commission, no fee, no promise of a performance. He wrote music because he had to.
I'm afraid that time, that old Tippett obsession, has defeated us once more. But many thanks to my two guests tonight, Oliver Soden and Ivan Hewitt.
And that was Rana Mitter. The producer was Laura Thomas. And if you're coming to a prom, have a look to see whether you might like to go to the Proms Plus event at the Royal College of Music beforehand. There's one every day. Welcome back to a very warm Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, for the second half of tonight's BBC Prom. Live, of course, as is every prom here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. And tonight, the home team, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, is being conducted by its artist in association, Oliver Nusson. They end with the first of seven works by Michael Tippett being performed at this year's Proms, the joyful, tender, fantastical Second Symphony. Before that, though, we hear again from pianist Peter Serkin, who's making his Proms debut this evening. After the concerto for piano and wind instruments at the end of the first half, he now tackles some very different Stravinsky, music he composed some 35 years after the concerto. He wrote his movements for piano and orchestra at the end of the 1950s and said the five short movements are related more by tempo than by differences of timbre, mood, character. In a work only 8 minutes long, construction must replace contrast. The movements explore new harmonic regions, some of them more complex than in any of my previous music. I'm amazed at this myself. Oliver Nusson.
I remember when Movements for Piano and Orchestra first came out, I believe it was written in 58, 59. It sounded just so sort of off the wall and modern music-y. I mean, people who like Stravinsky's other music, the earlier music, said, oh my God, he's really gone too far this time, or he's really gone off the rails. Because writing 12-tone music is one thing, which he's been doing for a few years then, but actually then this extreme fragmentation of the language, which is still striking today even. When I bought the recording and listened to it, you know, several hundred times, one started to feel that those notes were set in stone, that there was something absolutely right about the placement of every sound. And that effect remains with me to this day. This is, what's that, for nearly 50 years later. But it's a piece I love very much, and Peter has probably played it more than any other pianist alive or dead, and I've probably conducted it more than any other conductor. I mean, it's a little obsession of mine, this piece.
Oliver Nusson. Well, the result is an intense and very compressed work with the piano writing full of wide leaps. Stravinsky involves a large chamber orchestra, which includes harp and celesta, but only uses it in constantly changing small ensembles with the solo piano. In fact, he was going to call the piece Concerto for Piano and Groups of Instruments. And the last thing Stravinsky did to the piece was to add short interludes without piano between the movements. All's ready. Guest leader Jan Fischer played the piano to tumultuous applause and grinned broadly. But he's now back sitting, waiting as we are for Peter Serkin and Oliver Nusson. And here they come. Joining a chamber-sized BBC Symphony Orchestra on the Royal Albert Hall stage to perform Stravinsky's Movements. Stravinsky at his tersest, his most glittering in his movements for piano and orchestra, played to open the second half of this BBC prom by Peter Serkin, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Oliver Nussen. I heard a little clip of Stravinsky in French praising the BBC Symphony Orchestra back in 1934. He said, "Working with them always gives me much joy. The musicians achieve a close rapport with the music." Well, that hasn't changed in the last nearly 80 years, I'd say. As for Peter Serkin, well, he's busy teaching and playing. Just given another thumbs up to the trombones. Obviously, feels a close affinity with them. Going to be playing the Dvorak Piano Quintet with the Orion Quartet back home in Massachusetts shortly. And then that Stravinsky Concerto we heard before the interval for piano and wind with the Boston Symphony Orchestra at the Tanglewood Festival. Back he comes, the dapper figure. Warmly welcomed back and applauded by orchestra as well as audience. Actually, it's a very tight squeeze to get round past the music stand and the conductor's rostrum to get to the piano, which is where he's now got. I think we might get a little more. magical how intimate the Royal Albert Hall can become, isn't it? Lovely to watch the slow smiles appearing on the faces of the orchestra as they realised what he was playing. It's a charming little early song by Toru Takemitsu called I Just Sing. Takemitsu, of course, has written music, not that, but has written music for Peter Serkin, who returns once more, drew us all in with that performance. I think now he would say he's enjoyed his first time at the BBC Proms. Well, before we get to the final work on the programme, Tippett's Second Symphony, the piano has to be moved away, of course, which means the musicians of the BBC Symphony Orchestra are gathered just off stage, waiting for the word to go back on. And among them, I hope, is our roving reporter, Georgia Mann. Georgia.
I am indeed amongst them, Martin. I'm backstage just with the remainder of the orchestra who weren't on there with the sort of chamber formation during the Stravinsky, and there's a gentle murmur. Soon we'll have to move out of the way of some stampeding double basses. Two of the orchestra players, cellist Michael Atkinson and Martin Owen, have very kindly, principal horn Martin Owen, have kindly sort of stood to one side with me just before they head in for Tippett's Second Symphony, which we will be hearing in just a few moments. But I just wanted to start, Michael, with asking you, when this was premiered, this piece, one of the string players took a few liberties, we might say, sort of tried to improve on Tippett's string writing. Maybe not the best idea, but this is a very difficult play for the strings, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's very busy. There are a lot of notes per minute, and they're not necessarily the notes you're expecting. So they're not necessarily in the order that you're expecting them to be. So you're having to remain concentrated for the whole time.
No let up. Martin, do you get an easier time of it on the horns?
Barely easier, actually. I have to say, it's quite a challenging work for the horns. And just a couple of years before he wrote this Second Symphony, Tippett wrote a sonata for four horns, which was very virtuosic, partly because there was a wonderful horn player called Dennis Brain around at the time, and he wanted to really utilise his skill. And by the time the Fourth Symphony was written, Tippett really put in a lot of that kind of virtuosity into his work. So it's an incredibly difficult piece.
You mentioned the Fourth Symphony there. Earlier on in the year, you took on the whole cycle. The orchestra played the full four symphony cycle of Tippett's symphonies. How does this stand for you in that, in amongst the four, this second one for you, Michael?
For me, it's an interesting piece because it's almost purely classic, purely musical, the interest in it. When you get to the Third Symphony, it's much more political and social animal. But the Second Symphony is much more purely musical, inspired by Vivaldi and Bach.
Ah, yes, you mentioned Vivaldi, and Tippett did say that he had been sort of gazing at a lake and he drew inspiration when he heard, I think, Vivaldi on the radio, some crashing cellos in their bass line. Do you feel that inspiration when you're playing it, both of you? Can you feel Vivaldi coursing through?
You do, yes. But as a horn player, I have a slightly different role in the symphony. Whereas the strings, they start with this beautiful C ground bass note that they want to continue through the piece, particularly through the first movement. The horns, however, they want to ruin the party, rather.
Oh, so, no, never.
Well, it's never been done before, I'm sure. So they come crashing in a different key, which is intentional, by the way. And I think there are various stories about the very first performance of this piece, but whatever actually happened, it only stopped when the horns came in.
The horns come crashing in. I've never heard anything like it. Michael is casting rueful looks at his colleague, Martin Owen. Gentlemen, I will let you take your places back with your orchestra. Thank you so much for taking the time to catch up with us. Good luck. Back to you, Martin.
Thanks so much, Georgia. Georgia Mann down in the Bull Run here at the Royal Albert Hall with Principal Horn, Martin Owen, and cellist Michael Atkinson. As Georgia said, the BBC Symphony Orchestra has been exploring Tippett's orchestral music throughout this past season. And judging by the very respectable size of the audience at the audiences at the Barbican, and again indeed tonight for this prom, I'm not the only one who feels that Tippett has been neglected since his death 15 years ago. This season's proms are also going some way towards giving Tippett his due by programming seven of his works, the first of them his Second Symphony, which we'll hear in a couple of minutes' time. Conductor Oliver Nusson believes this symphony came at a crucial moment in Tippett's career, commissioned as it was by the BBC to mark the 10th anniversary of the third programme in 1957.
It's a piece that's at the sort of fulcrum of his life, it comes just after the period of the Midsummer Marriage and the Piano Concerto and these incredible pieces with millions of notes and this wonderful sort of Englishness and magical atmosphere. And there is a lot of that in it. But on the other side, the next pieces that he was to write, the opera King Priam and the Second Piano Sonata and the Concerto for Orchestra, were much more austere music made in blocks. Also very expressive and full of beautiful things, but a very different kind of continuity. And this piece miraculously has both worlds together. It's like the twilight of one and the dawning of another. For example, the slow movement of this piece consists of two or three different types of melodic statement. The movement ends by simply cutting them into pieces, and that's very characteristic of the later Tippett. The first movement grew from him hearing some recordings of Vivaldi, and that's obviously the trigger that made this tremendously athletic first movement take off. But there's a good deal of magic Midsummer Marriage music in that movement too. The scherzo used to be very famous among student conductors because it changes meter a great deal. The climax of the movement is really an orgy of cross-cutting between different types of additive bars. But in fact, it's a very nice, very charming movement, actually. And the last movement relates also back to a sort of English magic world, which is the Purcell Fantasias. It's a chain, as the Purcell Fantasias, also some of them are. It's a chain of different kinds of music, but this, in this case, just stated one after the other. The last one of which is the returning of the pounding Vivaldi seas, which has as much right to be there as anything else in the movement.
Tonight's conductor, Oliver Nussen. Well, it was a very big stage move, the orchestra coming back now gradually onto the platform, but gives us time to hear from Tippett himself, talking in 1960, soon after he completed his Second Symphony, when he spoke about what was expected of artists at the time.
I know that there's a great deal of present moment of preoccupation, or pattern preoccupation, of composers and other artists in purely technical terms. They, as it were, want to abstract all the human emotions apparently and produce an art which is so down to the rock bottom basis, and in the case of visual art, absolutely quite abstract. I'm desperately involved in the whole problem of what human beings are suffering at this time in an incoherent world, how they find any kinds of living pattern. I'm much closer in that sense to novelists than I would be to very abstract kinds of things. And yet I could not but know that the problems of abstracting something, of making limits within which you can speak, are absolute for the art. You can't have an artistic thing at all unless you have somewhere limited things and made a form.
Michael Tippett talking in 1960. Well, the Albert Hall platform is finally filling up with the full BBC Symphony Orchestra for the finale, as it were, of tonight's concert, from the intimate Takamitsu with Peter Serkin to Michael Tippett's Second Symphony. Getting to know Beethoven's work was a deep and essential musical experience for Tippett, and his Second Symphony has a Beethovenian ground plan, really, as well as those influences from the Baroque that Oliver Nussen was talking about. He wrote the symphony a few years after his opera A Midsummer Marriage, which you can hear at the Proms in a couple of weeks or so, and as Oliver Nussen was saying, there are echoes of Midsummer Marriage's otherworldly magic. In fact, you can hear the Midsummer Marriage complete in the Prom on Friday the 16th of August, starting at 6:30. Live, of course, here on the home of BBC Proms, Radio 3. And again, as Georgia was talking to the two players from the orchestra about Tippett, had an exact moment of first inspiration for the symphony. It was about the time he was completing Midsummer Marriage. He was sitting in a studio, apparently, at Radio Lugano, looking out over the sunlit lake and listening to tapes of Vivaldi, and he said it was that pounding bass line which threw him from Vivaldi's world into his own and marked the exact moment of conception of the symphony. I should explain to you what's going on here. There's Oliver Nussen very particular about where he seats people on the Albert Hall stage. And in order to get the trumpets down on a lower level with the upper wind, in fact, if you can imagine the steps up at the back of the Albert Hall stage, they're on the lowest level together with the flutes and oboes. But in order to get them there with the trombones and tuba behind them means that the double basses are somewhat crammed into the bull run and round the edge of the stage. And this is part of what's taking time now, and also to make sure that the basses are fully protected from the trumpets just behind them. The plastic screens are now being put into place, and as well as that, of course, as all the BBC microphones having to be adjusted, a lot of that having to go on between each piece tonight. So Jan Fischer, as you can hear, is now tuning BBC Symphony Orchestra. Talked about Midsummer Marriage, but that's not actually the first work of Tippett's that will follow this symphony here at the Proms. In the 3 o'clock matinee at Cadogan Hall this coming Saturday, with the Britten Sinfonia conducted by Sean Edwards, they'll be playing the Fantasia Concertante on a theme of Corelli, as well as music by Lennox Barclay, Hulst, the St Paul's Suite, and Britten, indeed. Britten's Phaedra ends the programme. That's on Saturday, 3 o'clock at Cadogan Hall. And now here once again is Oliver Nussen joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall to perform Tippett's Second Symphony.
Thank you.
The glowing ending of Tippett's Second Symphony, underpinned by those pounding bass notes he first heard in the Vivaldi Concerto, and which had been his original inspiration. The symphony's been performed here at the Royal Albert Hall to end this BBC Prom, live here on Radio 3 by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, guest leader Jan Fischer, conducted by the orchestra's artist in association, Oliver Nussen. Don't forget The Midsummer Marriage, performed on the 16th of August by tonight's orchestra with soloists and chorus, conducted by Sir Andrew Davis. The next Tippett at the Prom Saturday afternoon, the 3 o'clock matinee at Cadogan Hall, the Britten Sinfonia and Sean Edwards, the Fantasia Concertante on the theme of Corelli, as well as music by Leonard Sparkley, Holst and Britten. As for Oliver Nussen, I asked him what he's up to next. He said composing. Wouldn't be led into what? Sadly. Then he's got concerts with the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, when he'll be premiering a new piece by Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, Max. And the principal trumpet, guest trumpet of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Alan Harrell, brought to his feet. Alan Bolam, principal trombone. Wonderful solos throughout, bringing up all the wind section. Figure of Oliver Nussen, who reigned magisterially over the concert this evening, I would say. Well, I played the Concerto for Double String Orchestra with Michael Tippett as conductor as a teenager in the mid-60s. He galvanised us by treating us as proper musicians and made a disarming speech to the audience, saying it was a good thing for young people to play music that was less obvious than the Tchaikovsky Symphony we were going to perform after the interval. Perhaps, he said, even Tippett now and then. A bit more than now and then, I think. Well, tomorrow evening at 7:30, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra with its principal conductor, Peter Unjun, in his Proms debut, make their contribution to the BBC Proms Tchaikovsky Symphony Cycle with the wonderful fifth, Tchaik at his best. Oliver Nussen waving the score of Tippett's Second Symphony. Rachmaninoff, the third piano concerto with Nikolai Lugansky in a mammoth three-part prom. First, third, world premiere, Naresh Sohal's The Cosmic Dance. Another fascinating evening down here at the Royal Albert Hall. But for now, time for me to hand you on to Ian Skelly in the cool glades of Broadcasting House to guide you through the rest of your Radio 3 evening. Ian.
Martin, thank you. Yes, an Arctic scene here by comparison to the Kalahari-like conditions at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. That was Martin Handley sweating it out for us live at the Proms. Prom number 26 as we head towards the end of the third week of the BBC Proms. It's already produced fantastically exciting performances. Too many to list, really, when I think back to all we've heard so far, and so much more to come. Well, if you didn't catch all of tonight's Prom you have access to the internet, then do visit the Radio 3 website and listen to it again online anytime you'd like to over the next 7 days. And there are plenty of other Proms to listen to and watch on the iPlayer, including our lunchtime recitals, which take place during the Proms from Cadogan Hall every Monday lunchtime here on Radio 3. This year, as well as our microphones, Radio 3 has had cameras there, so you can watch the recitals online as well as listen to them. Well, what of the rest of tonight on Radio 3? In a moment, we're going to take a look at how crowd control has become a growing science. And then in our essay, we go back to before nonsense poetry was invented and discover why it suddenly emerged from the pens of the likes of Edward Lear. It somehow fitted with Victorian society, as you'll hear at 11:15. And Fiona Talkington will be here later tonight with more recordings from the WOMAD Festival last weekend.